and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Roz Taylor. My guest today is from Sweden, and she's an ethnographer, which means she studies the culture of particular societies. She spent time with a group of people whom you may not feel much sympathy with, women who refuse to take vaccines, and the COVID vaccine in particular. Mia Marie Hamelin, welcome to The Bunker.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We didn't always pay a lot of attention to it before COVID, but vaccine scepticism has been around for a long time, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, it has. Usually researchers like to pinpoint that it has existed as long as the vaccines. So you would find, for example, huge demonstrations in the shift between the 1800s and the 1900s. In different parts of England, for example, and also in Canada. And this was because of the smallpox vaccine that was changed, you know, from being voluntary to being compulsory. And this spurred these huge protests. So we would definitely recognize the placards, you know, the protests in the streets with long demonstration. So you would find these really big demonstrations concerning this change when it comes to the smallpox vaccines. And a historian, Durback, has written very interesting about this, I think, you know, that she has showed how this was also it was related to, or it was made in relation to, ideas of class. So it became a class issue. So the middle class, for example, they protested because of liberal reasons. And the working class, they demonstrated to kind of promote that they were not like filthy and non-responsible citizens, which some people claimed that they were. So there were definitely like class-infused protests you would find at that time, but really huge protests.
Yes, because the aristocracy generally supported it, didn't they? I remember Catherine the Great was a big advocate of the smallpox vaccine.
Yeah, you're right about that, yeah.
Now, you are not a vaccine skeptic, but you are particularly interested in why people reject vaccines. Most societies don't force people to have most jabs, but during COVID, in many parts of Europe, life did become more difficult if you refused to have the vaccine, didn't it?
Yes, and in Sweden, we are known for our high levels of social capital and also social trust. Which was shown through the way that we dealt with the pandemic in total, you know, the way we didn't have as many lockdowns, or we didn't have the same lockdowns that you did in other parts of Europe, for example, because the authorities and the politicians could trust in us to act in the way that they asked us to. But what also happened was that the vaccination criticism that we hardly knew that we had in Sweden were exposed through the COVID-19 vaccinations and when they were introduced. And one thing that these people found enormously annoying or also that they were super critical about was the vaccine passes, because this, they meant, was a way of transforming the voluntary COVID-19 vaccines into something compulsory, something you had to take. And we you know, this is probably also a discourse that you would recognize in the UK, for example.
Yes, we did. We had vaccine passports to go to a concert, for example. You had to show that you'd had the requisite number of jabs. So you decided to study the vaccine skeptic movement in Sweden. In fact, I think you were doing that before COVID. And you spent time with a group of middle-aged women, and you didn't just go and interview them. You actually spent time sharing what they were doing and getting to know them really well. What did you learn?
Yeah, my starting point was that after having made a couple of interviews with vaccine skeptical individuals, this is not what they walk around thinking of all the time. It's usually just a small part of their everyday life. And as an ethnologist, or you call me an ethnographer, you know, We always strive to meet people and understand them in their cultural context. We like to see people as active subjects, and we are also compassionate about the things that we study, you know, so we have like a compassionate attitude towards all our interlocutors that we meet. So, because we could track in Sweden, as elsewhere, a quite condescending tone when it, in different newspapers and other media outlets, you could find that kind of condescending, solidarity claiming arguments, pointing the finger to those people that didn't want to take the COVID-19 vaccinations for different reasons. And then I happened to find one of my interlocutors in a region in Sweden called Hälsingland. And I found her through movement on a platform, because in Sweden we had this movement that was official, that was called Roll Up the Sleeve. I don't know if you had the same in Britain.
We had similar campaigns, I think.
So Roll Up the Sleeve and Take the Jab, right? And then a counter movement was started online called Roll Down the Sleeve. So I found this woman through that hashtag, Roll Down the Sleeve hashtag. And she had this amazing way of portraying her vaccination skepticism. She used beautiful photos from her region where she comes from in Hälsingland, with black lakes, you know, and these deep forests and wuthering hills and winding roads. And it's such a beautiful area in Sweden. But it's also an area where you find the traces of urbanization and post-industrial area where you would find like big industries having shut down, and also empty stores, empty schools, and all these kinds of flight from the countryside, we call it in Swedish, you know, you would find these traces in this region. But I went there and I got to know her and also her friends, and I had the opportunity to spend some time with her.
And what were their reasons for not wanting the jab?
Their reasons, if I start with Anna, this main interlocutor, she became convinced when her children were small. She decided, after some severe thinking and researching, because usually they do use different sources to come to this conclusion that they don't want to take the jab. They do research. And she ended up in finding that she thought that vaccinations might be, because it's usually this kind of phrasing, you know, it's not like it is, but it might be more dangerous to the health than the actual infectious diseases that they are supposed to protect oneself from. She explained it in a way of relying upon nature to provide us with healthy, strong physical bodies that are meant to tackle these kinds of infectious diseases. And we do recognize this kind of reasoning from other vaccination skeptical or hesitant people, you know, the way they trust in nature and also the own body. And here I would say that the immune system, as she explained it, is made into something spiritual. It's something more than just a function in the body. It also has to do with spirituality in the way that you can strengthen your immune system by being spiritual, for example, and practicing spiritual rituals, etc.
This is something that a couple of my relatives who are also vaccine skeptical believe, that if you can look after your body, then you don't need, as it were, the state's help and intervention in order to protect it. So it gives people a feeling of autonomy, actually, doesn't it?
It does. And that kind of expression is so interesting today, I think. The need for individuals to say, it's my body. Here I will draw the limit between me and society. And I think vaccinations are super good at showing or highlighting exactly that limit between the body, because the shot is something that you actually take in your body, and you do it voluntary, mostly. In most countries, it's voluntary. And you do it when you're healthy. So it's something that you do to protect yourself in the future. And then we also have this omission bias connected to vaccinations, that it might be easier to be to become ill because you didn't take the vaccination than become maybe ill because of the vaccination. That's something you did, because diseases is something that we can't control. They just happen. They are everywhere. We will eventually become ill, and then eventually we will also become well again. So encapsulated in this kind of reasoning is the restitution illness narrative. The restitution illness narrative. And that narrative gives us it comforts us in the way that it tells us, you know, if we rely upon it, that we will recover, we will be well again.
Vaccine skepticism is linked to a whole plethora of other beliefs that tend to circulate in what you could call the QAnon universe. Things like the plandemic, that the pandemic was brought about artificially, perhaps by someone like Bill Gates, in order to be able to vaccinate the whole world. These beliefs circulate. How much did the women who you talked to sign up to that, or were their beliefs quite different?
To some extent, they did. An interesting reflection, you know, a reflection that I can make there is that when they spoke about potential conspiracy theories, you know, they wouldn't call it conspiracy theories in the first place, you know, but when their thoughts were drawn into that direction, they usually lowered their voices and kind of whispered. It was a little bit the feeling of that they didn't want it to be recorded, you know, or that this was dangerous to talk about. And I would say the most common way of speaking about conspiracy theories, that I would call conspiracy theory thinking, is the question mark again, you know, saying, could it perhaps be that, you know, what about this theory about this and that, you know? So it's not like most people don't claim that it is in a certain way, but usually they pose questions instead, which I find interesting. So,
is there a particularly Swedish angle to this? Because, as you say, Sweden has quite large areas of depopulated towns, areas that have been to some extent left behind, and maybe don't feel that they are part of mainstream Swedish life, or that they're excluded in some way. Did you find that played into what the women were saying?
Yes, to a certain extent, I think it is. It might also, you would maybe find the same pattern somewhere else, that, you know, in a similar region, in another country. But what I think is important to highlight is how they comforted each other in this exposed area. So they found comfort and their strength and their beliefs and the support they need in these small cultural communities. So this was like a small cultural community. And I think that Anna, for example, the main interlocutor, is a very strong person. Her main feature is humility. I mean, she was a very soft person and a very kind person, speaking with a quite low voice. So she was not a very, in that kind of way, she was not a protester, or she was not an angry person or anything. On the opposite, really, and also extremely generous towards me as a stranger coming from the university in the southern parts of Sweden. she invited me to different houses and to different and into saunas and into the forest that we took these long walks together with horses and everything. So she was enormously generous and also trustful. You know, she trusted me, a trust that I had to take care of, you know, and also respond to. But what I was trying to say is that I think that when being exposed, like I think in economically and in otherwise, you are in this depopulated area. And I think this was the case, you know, that they found their motivations to refrain from vaccinations together. And they were not organized, they were just friends. But I could hear when they spoke about their experiences from society also that they were skeptic about modern medicine. And some of them also had experiences of seeking help for different reasons, you know, for physical problems. And they were not listened to, and they were not... physicians didn't take their symptoms or problems for real, you know, or they didn't believe in them or whatever. So it was like this developed into a larger critique against modern medicine. And this is also that I can tracks that I can find in other interviews that I've made with vaccine hesitant people, that it usually starts with that they have seeked help through modern medicine, but they were left alone, you know, with their problems. They didn't get any help.
So they no longer trusted the state really to help them when they were in trouble. And that became a belief that they, you know, why should they do what the state asked them now?
Exactly. And it's not like these people in this northern region in Sweden protest loudly in the streets because of the lack of work opportunities, for example. You would never see that in Sweden like you would see in France, for example. Happens extremely rarely in Sweden, but you can protest in different ways, and I would say they do. And another aspect of it is that, because it is depopulated as well, it's an argument against vaccines per se. Like, who would give them dangerous infectious diseases there, where you don't meet that many people? So they feel safe because of it is a depopulated region as well. And I also mentioned the big forests and the lakes and everything, and this beautiful, beautiful landscape that they live in. And Anna meant, for example, that this in itself made her more open to a spiritual connection with Mother Earth, you know, or the world, really. So it's like the place itself does something to her that she can use to nurture her immune system, for example. And another word that it is used quite frequently is intuition. You know, this also a female angle of that, I think, you know, this female intuition that you just know, if you just listen in to your body, you would get the answer, what the body needs. And but the children who were unvaccinated then, you know, they are grown-ups now, and now they have moved to bigger cities. They don't live there anymore.
So people who refuse vaccines are often accused of being selfish and lacking solidarity. That's a narrative we saw a lot during the pandemic. And you can see why that comes about. You know, many of us wanted more people to be vaccinated so that society could open up. And it seemed to many of us that it was almost conditional upon people getting vaccinated. But how did these women feel about that? Presumably they didn't feel quite the same way.
That's true. And my impression overall is if you attack people on that point, you know, that refrain from vaccinations, it will only nurture their anti-vaccination sentiments. This is something that I've experienced many times when doing interviews with vaccine critical people. If you end up accusing them for lacking solidarity, they are like, wait a second. You know, you cannot say that about me. You know, they get really angry, really. So you could say that it's a combination of a lack of belonging to an imagined political center that also became visible during my ethnography, that is represented by the capital, Stockholm, that could be seen as an example of the reluctant margins of welfare. So you have the relationship on the one hand between people's actions to achieve their own goals and the structuring effects of politics on the other. So in this region, you could say that people don't allow themselves to become totally subordinated to the ideas of policy, but neither do they act in valiant resistance towards it. They don't protest in the streets, as I said earlier. But they do express reluctance against something. You know, it's like it could be something. So it could be that they demonstrate reluctance towards techno-scientific modernity in a more general way. So this local belonging that I could see in this place, I mean, firstly, they expressed solidarity towards each other in the group, but also towards people, all people that choose to not take the COVID-19 jabs, you know. So, and this is people that, these are people that they don't know, because this is usually how solidarity is described. Like, you have to feel solidarity towards people you don't know, otherwise it's not called solidarity. But they protect and stand up for everyone's right to say no to the jabs. And that could be interpreted, I mean, as a solidarity expression.
Tell me a bit about the rest of your project. One of the focuses is on rumors, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. So one of the studies that I'm working on now is a Twitter study where we try to understand people's way of spreading rumors concerning mRNA vaccinations or vaccines in particular. So it's interesting to try to find out what is it that makes people more afraid about those vaccines than other vaccines. And here we have also found that many authorities have tried to debunk rumors concerning mRNA vaccines in particular, saying that they can't alter the DNA, for example. But so this is a part of what we study right now. And usually I would say that rumors in general have an unnecessarily bad rumor that we need rumors, and it's a way of spreading knowledge before we have confirmed information, and sometimes it's actually very important to do it. And rumors are sometimes called the world's oldest news medium. So the spreading of vaccination rumors during a pandemic cannot surprise anyone, but it's very, very interesting to try to understand them.
Mia Marie Hamelin, Senior Lecturer at Lund University. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
And you can read more about Mia Marie's research at the Conversation website, if you Google her name and The Conversation. I'm Ros Taylor. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Daily was written and presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Kasia Tomaszewicz. The lead producer was Jacob Jarvis, with audio production by Tomas Rojas. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.